Hello, welcome to Forensic Forecast. That was a rather vibrant start. How are you doing, Simon?
I'm good, but no one near as excited as you are, apparently.
Well, I've got 2 weeks worth of excitement built up in me from the last podcast that we did, and I'm just raring and ready to go. Yeah, come on, get in.
Okay, you need to calm down a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I've overdone it on the Prozac, I think, to be honest.
Maybe it's a couple of days without sleep.
Well, yeah. My little boy's not been too well. He's not even a year and a half yet, and he's been in hospital for 4.5 months of his life. So it's when he's sick, he's sick, very sick, and we all suffer. So, but that's that, really. He's all right, though. He's fine. And hopefully tonight, my daughter's having a sleepover at one of her friend's house. Tonight, fingers crossed, a full night's sleep uninterrupted. A parent's dream, really. Whether it'll happen or not, well, we'll wait and see. It's sod's law and all.
I was going to say, you'll have to let me know in the morning if that happens.
Yeah, well, if I'm still alive in the morning. All right. Well, it's up and down. You see, that was depression following a brief...
It's remarkable how quickly it went from one extreme to the other.
I'm fine. I'm good. Peace. All right. So, we've got some interesting news stories today. Last time, I was accused of ranting somewhat about one specific subject.
You? I can't believe that.
I feel like you're mocking me. Why?
Me?
Why do people keep mocking me?
I'd never mock you, and so, I'd never use sarcastic tones.
Yes, for those of you who are new to the podcast, or maybe didn't hear the last episode just yet, I did have a little bit of a rant about this demented law which is blitzing its way across the United States, which landed in Texas and immediately made anyone who repairs computers a criminal. But thankfully, the first steps towards sanity prevailing are beginning to unfold. So here we have some computer repair people in Texas who are ready to sue the state of Texas. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Now, all we have to do is get all the forensic investigators to do the same thing.
Well, it's worth a try, isn't it? I mean, I think it's quite obvious that something needs to be clarified within the law, at least.
Yeah. I don't want to labour it, because we talked about it a lot last week. But the fact is that it's a stupid law. We know it's a stupid law, and it's only a matter of time until it's properly challenged and it falls apart, to be honest. It can't continue in its current form, and it really shouldn't continue in any form, because the thieving private investigators shouldn't be allowed anywhere near a computer to perform investigations, in my opinion. But that's just me. What do I know? I've only been doing this for a couple of years. Maybe other people have got a different opinion. Who knows?
So, yeah, could well have a different opinion.
You what, sorry?
Everyone's entitled to their own opinion.
Yeah, even if it's wrong.
Indeed.
So, yeah. There was an article which I was reading about it. You know, basically going on about how these repairmen feel like they can't do any of their job anymore, which basically makes them completely redundant. And in all fairness, they've got a good point. I mean, why on earth should they have to give up something which they've been doing for probably, you know, some of these guys will be working, repairing computers for, you know, 20 or 30 years. Why should they all of a sudden be stopped from doing it? It's just, it's wrong.
Yeah, well, that's just private investigators have decided that's what should happen, and they've managed to get their own way. But I think the interesting thing is when the state actually comes out and tries to clarify this law, some of the things they've said haven't exactly helped the situation. I'm looking at an article here that it says that a repairman can't actually legally examine a computer and then write any kind of a report for a company about this repair work. But the same repairman doing the same work for the same company can instead give a list of everything employees did on the computers without breaking the law. And so you think, well, what's the difference between the big long list and a report? It can be a name, really, can't it, that you give to it?
Yeah.
It's just getting messy.
Yeah, I hope they do sue the state. I hope they're successful and that someone actually looks at this properly, gets all the relevant parties involved, sits them down and says, what do we need to do to get this to work? And hopefully there'll be enough sensible people in Texas. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen. But hopefully there's enough sensible people in Texas that can actually figure something out here about what to do. Apologies
to anyone who lives in Texas.
I've got some friends who live in Texas, and so I feel I'm justified in making that comment.
You didn't hear what the apology was.
You what, sorry?
The apology was possibly going to be something along the lines of, sorry, you live in Texas, but that's a bit hard.
Damn, it's humid in Texas.
I've never been there, so I really can't comment.
Nah. So, thank you for all of you computer repairmen who are trying to sue. Love and peace, always. So now we've got that out of the way, the rant can end for this week. Let's move on to something else.
Before we move on to another story.
Oh, there's more?
I just wanted to wish you a happy rat catcher day.
Happy rat catcher day.
Yeah.
Elaborate, please.
I'll put that in. It's a day celebrated in America and Australia and several other English-speaking countries, possibly, except for England, I think, funnily enough, which kind of celebrates people who work in extermination a little bit. But it's a day kind of in recognition of the Pied Piper.
The Pied Piper of Hamelin.
That's the one. I believe there's only been one.
There's a holiday, well, not necessarily a holiday, but there's a day to celebrate the man who led rats out of a town and then came back and led all the children out of the town and basically kidnapped them all. Yeah. Well.
It might not be a celebration as such. It's just a day to...
No, I just wonder if we're going to have Hitler Day or Saddam Hussein Day in the future or something like that. People look back and say, well, it wasn't really that bad.
The whole never speaking of the dead and all that kind of thing.
Oh dear, rat catcher day. Maybe I should have a happy crazy raspberry ants day or something.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. All right, moving on before we completely lose our entire listener base.
Right. I think we still have three people left.
Do we?
That's you, me and someone else from our workplace.
I'm not sure they'll be listening after this. Okay. The infallible true crypt has been found not to be so infallible, Simon.
Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding. Wow. The method they use to hide hidden... Well, first of all, let's go back. Talk about true crypt. True crypt, fantastic piece of software. I would recommend it to anyone, regardless of whatever problems have been reported the last week or so. Basically, TrueCrypt is open source piece of encryption software. Allows you to create virtual disks, which are encrypted using a variety of different methods, in which you can have its own file system, and you can just bung files in there, and they'll just be encrypted on the fly. TrueCrypt also has this facility where you can create a hidden volume, a hidden encrypted volume inside the first volume, if that makes any sense, so that you've got something, you've got plausible deniability. You can say, I have an encrypted volume, here are the files that is contained therein. There's nothing else in there. And this hidden volume, until this week, we were not aware of any way that you could find that this hidden volume existed. But apparently that appears to no longer be the case, Simon.
Yeah. Sorry, I wasn't quite sure what to say there. But I felt like I had to say something because you paused.
All right, well, what's happened? Oh, let me just do this myself today, honestly. Rats.
What are you trying to say?
Oh, dear. But, yeah, basically, what's been found is that this TrueCrypt uses something called DFS, which is Deniable File System. And until now, it's been basically undetectable, so they can't, you know, if there was a hidden volume in there, or there were files within the actual original encrypted volume, you wouldn't be able to tell by looking at the way that everything's been encoded. It's supposed to be so mixed up that you can't actually find any way without entering the correct key of knowing what's in there. So, now, TrueCrypt, apparently, TrueCrypt 5 and below, 5.0 and below, apparently open to some kind of attack now, which means that you can find out that that either there is a hidden encrypted volume, or you can tell that there are files inside an encrypted volume. So it's a bit complicated if you want to have a look at any of the technical stuff. We'll post a link to it on the website. But the important thing is that TrueCrypt 6 has been released, which claims to have addressed these issues. And I've got to plug TrueCrypt 6. I just got to do it. It's got new feature on there, which allows the not just the encryption. Like TrueCrypt 5 allowed the encryption of the operating system. But what TrueCrypt 6 allows you to do is that you have you can have an encrypted operating system, and then you can also have a hidden encrypted second operating system, which means that, you know, you use your first encrypted one to do like all your regular stuff, and you use your second encrypted volume, second encrypted operating system to basically max out your internet bandwidth, downloading all illegal films and MP3s. So,
sounds like fun, doesn't it?
Let's face it, that's what people are really going to be using it for, isn't it? I mean, that's that's the only real reason to have a hidden operating system on your computer.
You could just be extremely paranoid.
Well, even if you're extremely paranoid, what have you got to hide? I mean, I personally don't like having my stuff posted all over the place. I cringe every time I hear that the UK government has lost another laptop or another set of CDs, or this last week have lost a number of USB thumb drives with, Ministry of Defence information on. And I cringe because I think, what if there's anything about me in there? Obviously not the Ministry of Defence stuff, I'd really hope not, but stuff like social security and benefits and all that kind of stuff, they get lost frequently, and I don't like that. It makes me cringe. But at the same time, I think that I'm a fairly average, normal person. And if there's anything on my computer which is considered to be questionable, then, you know, it's up to me, really, isn't it? I mean, but at the same time, if I'm going to have my computer examined at an airport or something, which is looking increasingly likely now, then I've got to put my hands up and say, yeah, the stuff on there is mine and whatever else. if you've been doing something illegal, you need to just stand up and put your hands in the air, really. But
yeah, I think it's one of those things where, for the most part, if you do illegal stuff, eventually you're going to slip up and get caught doing it.
Yeah.
And you can either be shown to have cooperated with things or to have been trying your absolute hardest to make sure people couldn't find what they were looking for.
Well, there's all kind of laws now as well, isn't there, saying that you have to reveal your password and all this, that and the other. But not just that, but then we've also got the next thing that we're going to talk about as well, which would absolutely scupper you, which is the cold boot attacks. And this is a fantastic story. I love this story. That people over at Princeton University found a way. This is old, this news. We're not just finding out about this now. I found a way to basically, if you contain the RAM, like manage to preserve it by spraying it with, you know, whatever, an air canister or freezing it or something like that, that you can actually preserve what's stored on the RAM, and then go in and search it. So what they've got now, what they've just released, just on Sunday, is the source code and the utilities for performing a cold boot attack. So effectively, what you would do is that you come onto a computer and say it had TrueCrypt 6 on it, for example, yeah? You've got the operating system, the encrypted operating system, and the hidden encrypted operating system. And let's say, you know, one or both of those passwords, it's possible that they could be stored in RAM. In fact, if one of those two are being used, that password will be stored in RAM, because there's no other way for the computer to really deal with it. So what they do is that you'd go along, you'd plug in a USB drive. This USB drive performs some operations, given the utilities that that were revealed at Hope this last week, and that would basically image RAM in a forensic manner, dump it to the USB drive, which you then go away, you run something like strings on it in Linux, or you manually try to pass it in Encase or something like that, and bang, you get the encryption password. Now, obviously, this means that you've got to come across a computer which is already on, and it's got some power in it. But a lot of cases, people don't turn the computers off, do they, Simon?
No, quite a lot of times people will put them in hibernation or something like that, won't they? And so, essentially, that information is it's stored on there somewhere.
Yep. And this applies to loads of different things as well. I mean, it doesn't just apply to TrueCrypt, but it applies to any full disk encryption. So we're talking about BitLocker as well. We're talking about DriveCrypt. All these other things. Then we're also talking about FileVault on the Mac as well. Because, like I said before, the encryption key, or the decryption key, has to be stored in RAM. There's no other way for the computer to decrypt things and encrypt things on the fly. So obviously we might see changes in that. Stuff like the TPM on a motherboard might be able to stall that in the future. But no one's found a way of really making a good use of that at the moment. So, but the full research paper is available. We'll put a link to that on the website as well. But this is going to make live forensic investigations a lot more common, I think, don't you?
I think it's going to make them a lot more useful as well as a lot more common, because if you're going into a first responding kind of situation and you've got computers that are on, but you're aware that you discover that some kind of encryption's in use, then you know there's a way of actually retrieving some of this information.
Yeah.
So you can get back into it if you absolutely have to. I think it's a huge security flaw, but one that I'm not sure how people would get around.
It'd be very, very difficult to legislate for this, but you've got to make sure that if you're one of these paranoid people, like you were saying before, you just got to make sure that your computer, if you're not using your computer, power it off. Just make sure it's completely off, and then hopefully the RAM will dissipate after a while. The contents of the RAM will dissipate after a while, and there'll be nothing left to image. And I think that's the only real way you've got of dealing with it, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, and if you're extremely paranoid, then when you turn your computer off, take your RAM with you.
What?
I don't know, that's probably not really practical in most situations, but on some laptops it's really easy to do.
Just turning off my computer. Screwdriver, please.
Yeah.
I guess you
obviously
could...
there's flaws in that.
Well, I mean, I suppose you could actually redesign your own laptop, couldn't you, so that the RAM is just stored on like a little thing, like a little removable tray that you just pull out whenever you're finished with the computer and then just walk off with it. And that way there's no...
The easiest alternative, though, would be to just, when you've turned off your laptop, keep it with you for a minute.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot easier than devising little ways of taking your RAM with you.
No, or you could carry a bottle of water with you and just pour it all over the computer whenever you turn it off.
You could have a use once policy for your computer.
You get the feeling
that could
getting
get
a
expensive
bit ridiculous
very quickly.
Yeah. However, one computer, just thinking about that actually, that wouldn't work on that computer you were looking at last week, would it, Simon? Pouring water on.
Which one, sorry?
It wouldn't... Okay, for people who don't know about Simon, right? When we did, like, our first or second podcast, Simon managed to spill a glass of water all over his EPC. Now,
yeah.
Thankfully, it after it dried out, it was fine. No problems. But last week, weren't you looking at a computer on the internet which would have saved you all this hassle?
Yeah, I was, but I think it's a bit... Yeah, well, it's certainly a bit pricey and a bit ridiculous. It was it was actually made by the same people, I think. I think it was an Asus, laptop.
Yeah, man, and, you want to buy a laptop?
It had been designed to withstand pretty much anything you could throw at it. It was waterproof for the most part. Well, splash-proof. And I think there was a video of someone driving over it in a car and picking it up and carrying it away.
But not turning it on.
That video missed the fact that he didn't actually open up the laptop and turn it on. So all we know is the case remained in one piece.
We don't know about all the internal bits of the computer, though.
It could have just been a large, expensive rattle. We just don't know. But yeah, certainly there are computers out there that can withstand things like that. And I think they'd be very useful to have if you're in situations where you're going to get blasted by a hose pipe or something else. But yeah, Most people don't use the laptops in such situations.
Yeah. So... going back to the cold boot attack for a second, here's what I think should happen now, okay? Helix 2.0, we think, I mean, I'm not entirely sure, I haven't checked the forums recently, but we think that's going to land sometime before the end of the year. What I think would be a good idea is if we could see Helix be implemented to work properly on a USB drive, and incorporate all of the cold boot attack utilities as well in that, so that we've got basically a complete first responder toolkit. Now, I don't know if these things are likely to be incorporated into stuff like coffee and the like, but we're still yet to see that, because we're not law enforcement, even though we work for law enforcement. Go figure. It's probably going to become more and more necessary for first responders, to be perfectly honest, because encryption is becoming cheaper and easier to implement all the time, and we need a way to...
You can't get much cheaper than free, can you, really?
Well, yeah, exactly. We need a way to combat things like TrueCrypt in the future. And I'm glad for research which shows that there are weaknesses, and I'm glad for cold boot attack research and all the associated research, because it just shows that, you know, these things made by man, they are going to have some fallible elements to them. They're not perfect, and because we're not perfect, we can't create anything perfect. So on and so forth, chaos theory, whatever you want to call it.
How profound.
So, you what, sorry?
How profound.
How profound, yes. so anyway. Simon, I think we need to tell them about your promotion, actually, because I think the next story ties in a little bit with it, to be honest. Simon, okay. Simon's just been promoted at work to a... What was your title again?
I'm a supervisor of mobile phone forensics for the company.
Okay.
Well, will be shortly.
Yeah, not yet, but in a couple of months. So, yeah, Simon's basically responsible for all mobile forensics performed in the office. And just almost to the day when that was made official, a new mobile forensics certified examiner qualification is announced, or certification rather. You want to talk about that for a little bit, Simon?
Yeah, can do. It seems like it's got the potential to be quite useful. It's obviously the same sort of idea as the CCE, the Certified Computer Examiner, but obviously for mobile phones and things like that instead of computers. Whereas it certifies the examiner rather than certain types of software, or certifies the examiner across a range of different techniques. I'm currently certified in the use of one of the more popular mobile forensics tools, but there are certainly another two or three that I'm likely to not really go on sort of certification type of courses for. And so something like this that assesses your actual understanding and your ability to work across several different tools is quite handy. It's especially more handy when you bear in mind that with all the different mobile phones and the like out there, no one tool is ever going to work for everything and do everything. You need a variety of different tools to be able to get into anything you need to get into.
All right, so a bit of information about this is that, unfortunately, it's not open to everyone, first of all. At first, Mobile Forensics Incorporated are only going to open this to 20 examiners. So what's going to happen is that you're going to be issued with what appears to be a proficiency examination that you would take on your own time and pass before you're allowed to go on to try to pass the certification process. So I don't know if they've already got the 20 people. It doesn't really make it very clear on the website, but if you want to be one of those 20 people, you need to go to mfce.us and try and get on there. Now, there is a... To be honest, I mean, my personal feeling is it's quite an expensive certification as well. I mean, when you look at, like, the ENCE, I paid £113 to do my ENCE, which that's like $230. The CCE is $395, or around about £200, and the MFCE is $695, or around about £350. Now, that to me does sound extremely expensive.
I would imagine once things start going, once it becomes available to more people, once they've got the capacity to deal with more people doing it, it will kind of settle down. It will find a level, and it might not always be that sort of price.
I can understand that. I can understand that the price might come down as well. The thing that that strikes me is that, you know, if they're only offering it to 20 people to start with, then, you know, the 20 people who are likely to pay $700 for it will take it. The others aren't going to be that particularly bothered. And so you might get 20 people to do it, and they might, you know, they might be saying, oh yes, we've got the MFCE. But everyone else would be like, so what? It doesn't mean anything. It's done by Mobile Forensics Incorporated. It's not a real, you know, it's not a specifically recognised certification yet, not like the CCE or the ENCE or anything like that. Or even the access data one, which temporarily escapes my mind. ACE, I think it is, isn't it? Yeah, if you could be ACE, that would be cool. Sorry, that was really crap. But I just, to me, I mean, when you compare it to other things, it's got less kick to it, less oomph, and it's twice as expensive, nearly, than the other ones.
I think the thing to bear in mind is that these certifications, they will have existed before they had their reputation, obviously.
Well, yeah,
so it's going to take some time for this to be recognised and assessed as important, but I think it will happen.
Yeah, I mean, it will take time, but like I said, I mean, it could become a lot more popular if they reduce if they didn't charge so much off the bat. That's my two cents, so, you know, that's...
I think what they're doing at the moment is probably more of a trial than anything. And we'll just have to see what happens and keep an eye on it, really.
Yep, fair enough. Just so everyone knows, in a couple of weeks I'm going to be going for my CCE. And if any of you out there mark the CCE... or grade the CC, and you see my name on the top of the paper, you know, don't let the fact that I do this podcast sway your decision as to whether
we'll
I pass or fail. Yeah, I would want to be marked down. What I want to affect your decision is the large wad of cash that might be making. No, don't let anything sway your decision.
I think it'd be more sensible to send a check, to be honest.
Don't let anything sway your decision, honest. anyway, moving swiftly on before I get accused of bribing people. I was talking to Simon just before we started recording, and surprisingly, Simon's never heard of Julie Amaro, however you pronounce her name, it escapes me. But I'm sure that most people have heard of her. If not, then basically sum up. 3 years ago, Julie Amaro was a teacher in the United States. She was using the computer in a classroom when suddenly lots of pop-ups started appearing, pornographic pop-ups started appearing that all the students could see. And she was arrested, taken to court. Forensic analysis was done on her machine, which the prosecution analyst said she made these things happen. She, you know, it's her fault, basically. The jury returned a guilty verdict, causing four counts of risk or of injury to a minor. But then, thankfully, once again, people being sensible, a group of forensic analysts got hold of the image taken of this computer, and were able to determine that that Julie, not only had she not accessed these things deliberately, but it all appeared within a few seconds of each other. So, unless she was extremely fast at clicking the mouse onto several different pornographic websites at once, there would had to have been pop-ups. So what's happened now is that the latest part in the story is that the judge vacated the ruling, meaning that no decision was made one way or the other. So that means that the prosecutors, the state attorney's office, they can go away and they can try and rebuild the case and come back. But in the meantime, what happens is that Julie Amaro, someone tell me how to pronounce that, please, is basically left without not being able to teach because she's been arrested on, you know, basically child sex offences, what they could become. And so she's lost her livelihood and she's just become a bit... It says, this article in particular says that she's in limbo. Now, this is off securityfocus.com, by the way. But it's quite shocking, really, that she's just been left out to dry, not being able to do anything. She can't work, she can't do anything. And they're not willing to drop the charges, and they're not pushing quickly for a retrial either. So it's quite appalling, really, the way that people are treated in conditions like this.
We see these things show up in the news, don't we? And I guess they're stark reminders to those of us who work in computer forensics and who, especially those who, I guess, work for the police or people who are looking for evidence to prosecute with, that we need to be pretty sure of what we're handing over and what we say in our reports and statements and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Because people's freedoms, their jobs, their careers... their lives, essentially, can hang on what we do. And if we just kind of jump the gun because we see something and we don't investigate it and find out how things got there completely, then these people can be wrongly accused, wrongly convicted, and regardless of what happens, it'll have messed up their life.
Yeah. No, I agree completely, and I'm sure almost everyone out there listening to this will agree with you too. Unfortunately, sometimes time isn't a luxury that we have to go through and deal with stuff like that. When you're faced with deadlines and stuff, people want things now. It can be quite... you can feel quite a lot of pressure to find something. But you just got to remain objective. You cannot deviate away. And if you find something, then you find something. And you just got to... You've got to determine whether or not the user was responsible. Because at the end of the day, it's this person's life that you're messing with, and it's your own reputation as a computer examiner that you're messing with as well. So,
I remembered reading some time ago, back when I was at university, from a book I believe was called Digital Evidence and Computer Crime.
By Owen Casey.
Yeah, by Owen Casey, it had a blue cover. It said that one way to tackle computer investigations, this is of course by no means the only way, but one is to, when you find something that you deem important enough to classify as evidence, you kind of formulate a theory as to how it got there, and then you work to seek to disprove that theory. And... if you disprove that theory, you think of something else, and you work until you disprove that as well. And that's the kind of way to stay objective, that you come up with ideas saying, I wonder if this is how it got there. You go and look and say, okay, it obviously isn't. And I guess that way it's a way of staying objective rather than saying, okay, I found this, now let's put the person at the crime scene, which seems to be not necessarily the right way round.
Oh, what you're effectively saying is that you've got to play devil's advocate, really. You've got to play the side of both the defence and the prosecution. And I got my own feelings on experts providing testimony for computers, which I've vocalised on a few occasions. But, you have to do everything. You can't leave a stone unturned. You've got to... This Julie Amaro case, like you said, though, it's not an isolated incident. Things like this do happen quite frequently. And the same article goes on and says that someone else served 16 months in prison for something that they allegedly did, just to find out they hadn't done it. So, you know, 16 months in prison, you've lost almost a year and a half of your life, and you're not going to get that back. And it's just, it's shocking, really, that people... I think what happens is people really get a bee in the bonnet about something, and that's all they can see. It becomes very, very. It becomes a very, very narrow field of view, and you just think, I have to get this person at all costs, and it's just wrong. It shouldn't be happening. But at the same time, you know, I'm willing to admit that if Julie Amaro is guilty of this, then so be it. Hold my hands up and say, that's fair. That's fine. That's fair enough. But there's got to be some proper analysis done from the prosecution this time. It can't be the slapdash job that it was originally.
I think that you as well as me, we've both done reports for the prosecution side of things as well as for the defence.
Yeah.
And when you do your first bit of investigation for the defence, you start to see things possibly a little bit differently.
Absolutely.
The first time you do it, you say, okay, this is what this person found. Now let's essentially see how much of it would stand up. And I took on a defence job not all that long ago. I got this guy's report from... he worked in a high-tech crime unit, and he put this report together. I read it, I looked through the job, and I thought, well, yeah, I've got to agree with most of that. And the guy looked fairly guilty. But then I started going into it in a bit more detail and looked at things, properties of files and things that had been saved in them by the software they'd used to edit them. And it painted essentially a completely different picture of what had happened.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how just one little bit of evidence can really turn around a perception on a whole job.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, like I said, you can't leave any stone unturned, really. You just got to do everything that you can. If you need more time, you've got to ask for it. You've got to say, look, I think there's something here that needs more investigation. And if they say no, then you've got to say in your report, I found this, but I've not had time to properly go in and confirm that this is the right, you know, that this is correct. I just finished doing a case on Hello, which Google saw fit to remove completely from their servers and everything now. So I had no way of testing the software. There was a very good white paper written about Hello, but there was some key stuff to do with these files that I couldn't determine where they'd come from. There was video files all over the place that were in Hello folders and whatnot. Did Hello do video? Did it allow you to trade videos? I don't know. I got no way of being able to tell. No one happens to know either in all the places I've looked. But so all I've been able to put in my report is, I'm sorry, I can't test this, I don't know. And I think you've got to not be afraid to say I don't know something, instead of saying, well, this is definitely how it got there, and trying to lift yourself up and make yourself look better. Because it's just not about that. Like I said, this is people's lives. We have to take it very, very seriously. So, anyway. Any fun, interesting news stories for us before we finish this week, Simon?
Oh, there's been one or two. Would you like the one about the rather self-centred criminal? The one about the idiotic use of sat-nav, or the one about the people who don't know what plane they're catching?
Let's have the sat-nav to start with.
Okay, the sat-nav. This is a story about a lorry driver who travelled from or who was assigned to
a lorry is a like a semi for people listening in the States.
Yeah, that's true. I wasn't sure what to call it, so I thought I'd let you fill that in. He's a Syrian driver, and he was asked to take a load of luxury cars from Turkey to Gibraltar.
Okay, where's Gibraltar, Simon?
Gibraltar's a little island that's absolutely nowhere near the UK, as far as I recall.
Okay.
And so this guy was sent with these luxury cars. Off you go. He puts Gibraltar into his sat-nav, and he's directed to a remote part of the UK that happens to be called Gibraltar Point. And he got this this 32-ton lorry down these narrow little country lanes, and then discovered that that wasn't where he was supposed to be going.
He's in completely the wrong country. Completely the wrong country.
We've heard of sat-nav mistakes in the past, like the people who blindingly follow their sat-nav when it tells them to literally drive off a cliff or things like that.
Or drive into a river.
Yeah, things like that. People have actually done things like that. And you just think, well, how stupid do you have to be? But anyway, this is what one guy did. Luckily, the company were willing to ship these luxury cars from the UK to Gibraltar. So he was able to just essentially go home and give it up as a bad job, really. But when using technology that's supposed to make your life easier, make sure you use it properly.
Yes.
Otherwise, it doesn't make your life easier.
All right, well, I think we're going to call it a day there. Appreciate everyone's downloading the podcast and continue listening. We hope we're entertaining you. If we're not entertaining you as much as we could be, let us know what else we can do. We're always interested in hearing some feedback. And in fact, I think next week I'm going to address a couple of posts which people have made to the website, and we'll have a little bit of a discussion about some of those, as well as the latest news. But thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Simon.
No problem.
And hopefully we'll get to talk to you again next week. Bye.
Bye.